Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Hi, I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream my show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. The COVID-19 pandemic changed the way many people ate. Stress, economic hardship, and lifestyle changes affected eating habits, and many people reported that their diets worsened over the past year. Nutritionists heard concerns about people skipping meals, restricting eating, or overeating. This hour, I'm talking with a nutritionist and a doctor about eating healthy and how to reduce the amount of sugar and salt in our diets and how to add more nutritious foods to our meals. And I want to hear from you. Have your eating habits changed over the past year? Are you planning to make some changes to what you're eating this summer? What questions do you have for our guests? Give us a call at 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at Angela Davis NPR to join the conversation. Also, later in the hour, NPR's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell will be joining us, and he will get us up to speed on what is happening with the economy, plus what is going on with the price of groceries. Let's bring in our first two guests. We have Jamie Stang with us, and Jamie is an associate professor of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota. Jamie is one of 20 experts in the United States chosen to craft the 2020 through 2025 dietary guidelines for Americans, and that is published by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Health and Human Services every 5 years. Good morning to you, Jamie.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. We appreciate your time. Also on the line, we have Christy Hughes. And Christy is a functional medicine practitioner as well as a naturopathic doctor. She goes by Dr. Christy, and she has a new clinic that is opening in Mound in a couple of weeks. Good morning to you, Christy.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Well, first, for Jamie, a question for you. How would you describe what has happened to the eating habits of a lot of folks during the past year? What kinds of stories have you heard?
Yeah, it's been kind of a fascinating time. We've seen a fair amount of people gain weight and gain a significant amount of weight, but we've also seen that some people have lost weight. We've seen people cook more than ever. About 44% of Americans say they're cooking more during the pandemic than they were before. And then gardening. I happen to be a master gardener, and we are just seeing an explosion in people who are interested in growing their own food during this time. So it's just changed in so many different ways.
Well, from cooking more to gardening more, clearly people are now paying more attention into, you know, what are we putting in our bodies? So that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. You know, I think though the caveat to that is people are cooking more, but we had these unexpected food shortages, and we've had some changes in prices where things have gone up at times, and then prices have gone down, and then they've gone back up. And so while people are cooking more, the question is whether or not they're cooking just healthy foods more, or are they cooking more comfort foods and things that may not be quite as healthy as we would like for them to be.
And so let's talk about what is going on in people's lives that cause them to have different attitudes about what they ate and the effect of some of those choices. I mean, if we just look at like traffic and working from home, rather than, you know, making that long morning commute and then maybe packing your lunch, or the way that probably even affected breakfast choices.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that people are what they're eating has changed a bit. So they're talking about eating less meat, and they're talking about but they're eating more snacks and more bottled water, which I suspect is part of that eating from home. You're around the food that's in your house all the time. So mm-hmm. that ability to just walk up to the kitchen and grab something while you're on a Zoom call has changed, I think, people's eating quite a bit. And then stress. You know, some people tend to eat less when they're stressed. Quite a few people tend to eat more when they're stressed. Mm-hmm. And that combination of being more stressed and then being at home where you're surrounded by food with easy access all the time has been difficult for some people.
And Jamie, what can you tell me about fasting? Because I've read some reports that fasting and intermittent fasting became very popular.
Yeah, so we actually looked at that as part of the dietary guidelines. I wasn't on that particular subcommittee, but the committee as a whole looked at the data. And they actually, there's not a lot of data to suggest that fasting gives any particular benefits over not fasting. Actually, just in general, when you look at how people eat, and we had a subcommittee that looked at the frequency and the timing of eating, it's amazing how little understanding we actually have around that, around whether the grazing pattern is actually more healthy or whether, you know, having long periods of not eating followed by periods of eating. There really is not a consensus in the published literature or just talking to people who do work in that field. There really isn't a good consensus as to whether or not that's beneficial or whether it might be beneficial for some but maybe not other people, depending upon their level of cardiometabolic health.
Dr. Christie, tell us more about the work that you do and what exactly is a functional medicine practitioner?
Sure. The Institute for Functional Medicine is renowned and known around the world for training postgraduate physicians in functional medicine. And so you've got traditionally trained or classically trained healthcare providers who, after they complete their MD, their DO, their nurse practitioner degree, or their nutrition or dietetics degree, they will often go on in their postgraduate and study the approach of functional medicine. And what functional medicine does is it bridges both the art and the science of great medicine. And so it's looking at modern, updated studies, understanding how or why we may apply lifestyle, food as medicine, and even movement or exercise as medicine. So in functional medicine, the goal is always looking to see, can we identify any of the struggles or challenges in diet and lifestyle that are making it more difficult for that patient to transcend or move forward in their health care? And so regardless of which type of practitioner you're working with, the approach is going to be the same. It's personalized care. It's more precision understanding. It's looking at root cause medicine with a large emphasis, as Jamie pointed out, a large emphasis during this post-COVID window has been looking at cardiometabolic unique needs for individuals, some of their nutrigenomic special needs that are present. It's all about getting to the underlying causes of disease and doing true preventive steps that are right for that unique person.
And so what have you heard from people about how their eating habits changed over the past year as we were living through the pandemic, just trying to survive the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly for me, I was an international speaker. I spent about 25% of my time flying all over the world teaching physicians and healthcare providers about nutrition. That came to a grinding halt, obviously, last year in May. And one of the teaching teams I was on, we were actually supposed to be in Wuhan presenting last year in February, teaching functional medicine in China. Mm. And so it was a very interesting kind of cold stop in some of the aspects of on-site natural medicine and natural healthcare education. And for me, I went back into full private practice. We instantly had to pivot, and I was instantly on full telemedicine Zoom calls with my patients. And, you know, what I heard over and over again was the impact of the isolation. You know, for those individuals who are living alone or more segmented and away from other family members, especially my patients who are over the age of 60, right, who depended on more of that inter-family, intergenerational connection points, you know, a lot of the struggles that I saw in diet and nutrition were really the semantics of the boredom of going to the kitchen, feeling more depressed about eating alone. You know, some of the classic patterns are out there with sugar and bad habits and grazing, but, you know, some of my biggest concerns were, you know, people eating alone and not feeling motivated enough to get out and go to the grocery store and get themselves some fresh, real, live food instead of eating out of the freezer all the time.
And so do you find that doctors tend to be reluctant to talk to people about what they're eating or about their eating habits or recommending that they eat more healthy? Because you talked about the work that you do. You're sort of trying to connect nutritionists and doctors so that there's a better understanding and how to communicate that as well.
You know, I do see it's very interestingly dependent on the doctor. It's dependent on their own experience, their own training. And, you know, what I have observed, I've been in clinical practice now for over 24 years and in medical education for over 20 years. And what we are seeing is a strong movement of traditionally trained or allopathically trained healthcare providers recognizing that the 14 to 16 hours of nutrition that they had dedicated to them in their 8-plus years of medical school, you know, it's not enough. And we know that food is medicine. We can break down phytonutrient pathways. We can understand the powerful gene modifications of specific food choices we may make. And so what we are seeing is a beautiful surge of healthcare providers of multiple different backgrounds and types who are looking and seeking for good quality medical education because they want to inspire their patients. And so many of us know we're up against Dr. Google all the time, right? So we have patients who walk in the door with stacks and stacks of, I read this on the internet. And, you know, in the world of nutrition, you know, I always say some of the most controversial topics in the world are honestly looking at religion and nutrition, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of beliefs around nutrition. And then as Jamie stated, then there's the science, you know, to nutrition. And so honestly, going back to our physicians and your question, you know, how many physicians are engaged in nutrition, it has a lot to do with their personal life and their experience. You know, what have they had a desire to learn and dig deeper into? And it does remind me sort of where we are now in healthcare. It reminds me of where we were about 10 years ago in some of the studies looking at exercise as medicine in physicians. And there's studies that really point to practitioners or healthcare providers who are engaged in strength training programs. They recommend strength training to their own patients. And if you look at physicians who are involved in cardiovascular or more endurance programs, they recommend more cardiovascular activities and prescribe to their patients. And those same studies looked at physicians and practitioners who didn't work out and who didn't have a personal activity or fitness program. And what we expect is they didn't talk about it with their patients. You know, so I wish we could say in a blanket way, all healthcare providers are starting to really see food as medicine. But what I can say is there's an opening, there's much greater interest. The science is a lot more solid than it ever has been before. And I am extremely excited and encouraged about the way in which collaborative care teams are coming together, where we are seeing primary healthcare providers surrounded by the right nutrition professionals who've dedicated the years of their life to those degrees, right? You can't expect 16 hours or 20 hours of class time over a decade to get you where you need to be. And so the power of pulling in those right credentialed nutrition professionals to work hand in hand with a physician is an ideal situation with great clinical outcomes for the patient.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about food and our eating habits. And I want to hear from you. How have your eating habits changed over the past year? Are you planning to make some changes now that it's summertime and you're more committed maybe to eating more healthy? What questions do you have for our two guests? They know a lot about this. The number is 651-227-6000. Tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR, as we talk about our eating habits. And Jamie, I know I've read repeatedly that you know, genetics and healthcare and physical activity, as well as socioeconomic factors, all of those are critical when it comes to good health. But I also keep reading that the most important driver of good or bad health is the food we eat, what we're putting on our plates. What can you say about that, Jamie?
Yeah, I think that food, there's a lot about food that we don't really understand in terms of how it relates to health. A lot of our work up to this time has really focused on individual nutrients, and that sort of reductionist approach to nutrition really hasn't gotten us, I think, to where we want to be. If, you know, people don't eat vitamin C or vitamin D or folic acid. They eat food and they tend to eat food in patterns of food. And so we really need to understand that context of how and why people eat food and how and why they eat the specific types and amounts of food that they do eat. And so I think that's sort of the piece that that we've really been missing in a lot of our work. And it's where, you know, you talk about like the social determinants of health. Well, now I think COVID has really opened people's eyes to how many people really do live in marginal food situations. where they're having to choose between whether they're going to spend money on rent or medication or healthcare versus whether they're going to spend money on food. And then we talk about just, you know, the family context and how busy people's lives are and access to food. And there are just so many pieces of it that we tend to want to look at nutrition as, you know, like I said, these very specific nutrients. And until we look at it very holistically, I think we're not going to truly understand what motivates people and what deters people from eating in a more healthy way.
So, Dr. Christie, advice. I'm looking for advice. What advice do you have for people who want to turn over a new leaf this summer? Because I feel like people tend to eat better, make better food choices during the summer months. Is that even true? Do you find that to be true?
Well, it can be in regards to them really looking at their opportunities with fresh food. And I think one of the wonderful opportunities that summer brings to us here in Minnesota is these fantastic farmers markets, right? These opportunities to really get connected to our communities, looking at our CSAs, looking at some of these great farmers in our communities that are working hard to bring that farm-to-table experience, right? So I think looking local, getting this opportunity to see what is available and what's fresh. So I think, yes, there's no doubt about the fact that people tend to eat more fresh food, more live food. They get a better range of phytonutrient diversity and density, you know, here in the Midwest, because we just don't see that same access available in the winter months. You know, I think also movement is an important piece of it. You know, as a naturopathic functional medicine provider, you know, food is the core center of what we talk about, but fitness is a close runner-up. And, you know, my husband and I own a gym out here in Mound. We're on the west side of Lake Minnetonka. And so the people that come in and out of our door every day, you know, they are expressing all their struggles and challenges with COVID. And it's, you know, it's almost an incestuous conversation around food, nutrition, and movement, right? Because so often, you know, what we choose to eat depends on how we've moved or if we have or haven't moved, you know, and so people often will be gauging to what they're eating, when they're eating, how they're eating, you know, in accordance to whether or not they're getting adequate exercise, whether they're moving at all, or they have slumped back into some of these sedentary patterns, you know, that we've certainly seen. So it's a combination factor, right, of how we eat and how we move that tends to make the summer months really quite interesting for us here in Minnesota.
So how do you make a fresh start? How do you begin if you want to, you know, you're hearing this conversation and you're like, yes, I'm going to change up what I'm eating. I'm going to pay closer attention to what I'm eating.
I think it's really important to have goals and have realistic goals. And honestly, there's so much confusing information that's out there. Mm-hmm. It's valuable to have a good nutrition professional, a physician that's oriented towards nutrition, or a great coach that's trained in these areas to help support you to get there, right? Because you can find dozens and dozens of menu plans and recipes off the internet, but you need to make some principal decisions about what's going to guide your food decisions. So key things to be looking for, especially in this post-COVID era where we're looking to strengthen and support immune resilience and really make sure that the cardiometabolic complications are addressed, we need to all be eating very carefully in the realms of keeping our sugars under control. The glycemic impact of foods that relates to both the glycemic surge and the insulin surge that follows different foods or meals that we consume is and was an important part of this COVID story. So in pandemic medicine, what we came very quickly to recognize is that the higher risk classification of individuals often went hand in hand with those who were at higher risk for cardiometabolic concerns. So that leads us back to higher glucose levels, higher belly fat storage, higher levels of blood pressures, elevated triglyceride levels, and a pre-diabetes picture that is known as cardiometabolic syndrome became a really important central story for many of the higher at-risk patients and the COVID, post-COVID long-haul syndrome story. So there's a whole realm of eating for your mitochondria that really has emerged in the functional medicine and functional nutrition era in post-COVID support, because so many of the individual patients ended up struggling with or challenged with their ability to produce cellular energy, to have adequate oxygen perfusion and oxygen exchange, that really eating for healthy cellular energy exchange to build ATP and drive healthy cellular function has really become a precedent. So many of the functional medicine medicine providers all around the world are using dietary approaches to help fuel the ability of the cells to metabolize efficiently, driving healthy brain function, keeping glucose and insulin levels in better balance, and striving to keep inflammation levels lower.
So, Dr. Christie, are you talking about sugar consumption as you talk about that? And Jamie, before we take a news break, what would you want folks to know about sugar and how much sugar we have in our diets?
Well, it's interesting because sugar is a very dividing nutrient. When we looked at the dietary guidelines, we actually recommended a reduction in sugar intake down to less than 6% of calories. Right now, for the average person in the U.S., it's about 16% of their energy. The U.S. dietary guidelines actually state 10. The evidence really says that 6% or less is actually a better place to be. So I think we have a long way to go, but cutting back on your sugar-sweetened beverages, your sweet snacks, all of those added sugars are really taking a toll on our health.
Right now, we're talking about food and our eating habits. And did the way you eat change over the last year? Are you trying to make some different food choices this summer in an attempt to eat more healthy foods? Well, my guests today include Jamie Stang, an associate professor of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota. Jamie is one of 20 experts in the U.S. chosen to craft the new dietary guidelines for Americans. We also have the line on the line, Christie Hughes. Christie is a functional medicine practitioner and a naturopathic doctor. She goes by Dr. Christie. And I want to hear from you. What are your stories about what you're choosing to eat? And are you trying to make some better choices? Give us a call at 651-227-6000. Again, the number is 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at Angela Davis, MPR. All right, let's go to the phone lines. In Minneapolis, we've got Becky on the phone. Good morning to you, Becky. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. Well, you know, I had cake for breakfast, Becky. I'm just going to tell you. Not off to a good start.
Yeah, cupcakes are good, too.
Yeah. So what's your story? What are you dealing with food over the last year?
I moved in with my boyfriend, I guess. I'm 68, so I would use significant other, I guess. Mm-hmm. Before COVID-19, and I'm a vegetarian, and up until then, I had been on an eating plan that my staple is pinto beans or black beans. And vegetables. And the only thing I had at my place was celery and organic peanut butter. I try to eat mostly organic. But when I moved in here with him, his eating plan is different from mine. He is not a vegetarian and he likes his snacks. He takes care of himself, but he can eat that stuff. I can't. You know, I can look at it like they say and gain 10 pounds. So I have gained 10 pounds over the last year and a half due to COVID quarantine because we have health issues. And I'm wondering if the guests have any tips on how to stay away from that because, you know, we have to combine our different eating habits in one house. Mm-hmm. I can't say to him, don't buy chips and M&Ms, which are screaming to me from the cabinet right now.
Yeah, they do make noise. Yep, the chips,
yeah, they do.
They talk. So. All right, Becky, that's a great question. I think a lot of people have that situation where you have an eating plan, you have an idea of what you like to eat and what keeps you feeling good, and then you have other people in the household who have a very different approach and who are eating different, you know, foods, other foods. So how do you, what would you recommend for someone who is dealing with that situation, Dr. Christie?
I think it's a real common challenge. I appreciate that the caller is bringing this up. I think it is a situation that can be really a struggle. And I think it really breaks down to having a good open conversation about it, right? Because so often we find that when we're making any healthy lifestyle change, whether it's a dietary modification or changing our sleep schedule or starting an activity or a movement pattern, we really need to have our supporting people around us, you know, that community that's going to help ensure that we get there and not in any way sabotage that process. So I think it really does begin with a conversation and identifying, you know, what true goals each individual has and making sure that we're understood. So I think there's a conversation to kind of open things up and to really talk about how important that social environment is. You know, there's a lot of interesting science out there on network medicine, you know, that shows people who smoke hang out with smokers. People who run marathons have friends that run marathons. You know, individuals who move a lot often are friends with people who move a lot. And we know that there's a lot of success that's out there in surrounding surrounding yourself by people that do the same things, it can be quite a struggle. So I think it begins with a conversation. Sort of safe spaces can be established in the house, and I think it's a team plan moving forward is key. We sometimes have to do this with families where we have multiple food sensitivities or allergenic concerns or genetic predisposition struggles with foods. And we have six people who are living in a household, right? And we've got a mom and dad who are trying to figure out how to feed everybody. So I think it begins with a common denominator, deciding, are we here to talk about food or are we here talking about snacks and other things that are associated with other senses of dopamine, hits of joy, and other forms of pleasure, right? Is it really about the food or is the food giving us something else?
And what about you, Jamie? What would you recommend Becky do? And she's in a household with someone who makes different food choices than she does.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of snacks, one of the things that we've often recommended to families is if the person really cannot give up the snacks that the other person doesn't want to eat, can you modify? Can you use baked chips instead of fried chips? Can you make some small intermediate steps that maybe get you away from some of the higher fat, higher sugar content? And quite frankly, they're maybe not as palatable, so you're going to reduce that a little bit. In terms of the vegetarian piece, that's something that I hear a lot. And oftentimes there are ways that you can start implementing more plant-based protein in, so using beans in tacos as opposed to meat, and sort of making those gradual changes rather than, you know, trying to drag somebody full force, like we're just going to stop eating meat and you're going to become a vegetarian today. There are ways that I think we can try to work in small steps toward the middle and view it as sort of, you know, over the next 3 months, let's see if we can get to this point.
I like that. Let's take another phone call. And Egan, we have Laura on the phone. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. My question is in regard to, you were talking about sugar and insulin levels and glucose, and I'm wondering, is stevia and maybe birch xylitol considered to be healthy alternatives, or does your body see them the same way? You should also avoid those.
All right. Laura's asking about sugar substitutions, stevia in particular. Dr. Christie, what would you say to her?
Sure. We do have patients who do use stevia as a gentle replacement, and truly mung fruit is becoming a real common replacement as well. In general, they do tend to have a lower insulin spiking capability. It's really important that individuals who are tracking their glucose levels at home are watching that. Now, with the introduction of continuous glucose monitors, it's quite remarkable that individuals can watch on their app how their body's responding to meals and movement all day long, right? It's new technology is pretty fantastic. But I would say it's really getting back to understanding the glycemic impact of those foods, being able to really separate out the different fruits and vegetables and understanding which ones tend to keep a lower glycemic release taking place. That's really the direction to go, you know, at this point, especially if you're looking at body composition goals and the burning of body fat and regulating that glucose and insulin. So eating an apple instead of drinking that apple juice, having a handful of berries, you know, is a great solution when you're looking for some type of a little sweet fit so that you can get that nice little fiber burst that's there, and knowing how to differentiate between your veggies. You've got, you know, starchy versus non-starchy, and a lot of people don't realize that those starchy vegetables like your potatoes, your root veggies, your squash, you know, this entire family acts a lot like a quick spiking sugar, or often acts and behaves a little bit more so like bread than even a vegetable. So being able to understand high versus low glycemic foods and eating those low glycemic fruits and vegetables and grains, that quality makes a big difference in the big picture. So I would really go back to those food lists. If you need them, we have easy access to getting low glycemic food lists. You can find those quite comfortably. Watching those levels as a key solution, sometimes that in meal timing is all it takes.
And Jamie, any conversations that you all have been having about sugar substitutions, stevia in particular, this caller is asking?
Yeah, stevia, you know, I think is a great sugar substitute. The one thing I would say is there's a body of literature that really also points to the fact that sometimes people don't lose as much weight or don't seem to have quite the effect when they're using sugar substitutes as they thought it would. And part of this may be because as long as you're still having sweet foods, even if they're not as caloric, but you're still buying into that idea that beverages have to be sweet or foods have to be sweet, that then when those are not available, you tend to go back to the sugar sweetened beverages and foods. And so as much as possible, trying to also reduce the amount of just sweet tasting food, whether or not it's got sugar in it or artificial sweetener, over time can be very beneficial because it starts to break that cycle of always reaching for something that has a sweet taste.
I want to bring in a comment on Twitter. Twinkling wrote this, Angela, please remember to emphasize that weight gain is okay and normal and healthy, especially when surviving a pandemic. Overall well-being is so complicated as we emerge from this experience. And so over the last year and 3 months or so, we've had a lot of conversations about mental health. And I know that many people, again, were doing what they could just to get through the pandemic. And so to both of our guests, what would you say to people about weight gain and that it is, you know, not something to punish yourself about? Dr. Christie?
Yeah, I would agree. I think where you gain the weight is an important piece and where you are at the various different phases of your life. You know, if you're a peri into postmenopausal female and you went through this pandemic, you stopped menstruating and you gained more of your weight in that lower external abdominal area, that's expected, right? That's a part of some gentle, normal transitions in life, right? If you've been working out, you've been fit, you've been walking around with a 28% body fat, and all of a sudden your clothes have changed, your waistline has changed, and your triglyceride levels are going up. You know, that's the kind of weight gain that's happened in a way that's having more of a metabolic complication. So how you gain the weight and where you gain the weight is important. It's not the number on the scale, right? That inner belly fat, if we found that we sat more and we ate the wrong foods during the last year with the stress, and it led to increased levels of visceral adipose tissue, that's the inner belly fat. That's hot fat. That fat communicates. It crosstalks. It turns on inflammation. It accelerates insulin resistance. That fat is not doing us any good, right? But if we gained a little bit of stress fat or more of that outside that we can kind of hold on to and grab onto like a love handle, yeah, we're right. I mean, we don't want to beat ourselves up over that at all, and we're not going to see that translate over into those straight metabolic blood markers, you know, putting us at risk. So a little bit is okay. It's a perfect time of the year to reset ourselves, right, and use this launch into the summer time frame to move more, eat right, pace ourselves well, and sleep right. So many people underestimate the power of sleeping and the power that sleep has on healthy body composition regulation. So know the fat. What kind of fat? Where is it being held? And I agree, we don't want to put those extra layers of stress on top of all we've been through. But let's get aware and be mindful and make healthy choices.
And Jamie, what would you say to people about weight gain?
Yeah, I would echo what Christie said. I think, you know, really the number on a scale is the number on a scale, and it does, you know, give us some indication of what's going on. But really, the bigger question is, what's the quality of our behaviors? What's the quality of the diet that we're eating? Are we getting enough exercise? Are we taking time every day to be mindful or to meditate or do whatever it is that reduces our stress, that focusing more on the behaviors, which are the pieces that we can make concrete changes in, are going to be a lot more useful than focusing on a number on a scale.
All right. Well, our time is up for this conversation, but I want to thank our two guests who provided us with a lot of helpful information. Jamie Stang, an associate professor of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota, one of the 20 experts working on those new dietary guidelines for Americans. Thank you, Jamie. And also to Dr. Christie Hughes, a functional medicine practitioner. Thank you, Dr. Christie, and good luck with opening that new clinic there in Mound. It's been a while, but on Mondays, you know I like to spend some time talking about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the economy, both nationally and locally. So joining me right now is NPR's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell. He's back. Welcome back, Chris.
Oh, well, thank you for having me back. And, well, I have to tell you, Angela, I'm hungry.
Well, no, you had cake with me, too, this morning for breakfast. We have a new senior producer for our show starting today, so we had a celebratory cake. So, but you just heard that conversation about food and cooking and our eating habits. And so I know you've been telling me you've seen some news recently about the price of groceries. What can you share with us about that?
Oh, yeah. So when you go to the checkout counter, don't you feel like you're spending more? I mean,
yes.
For just, you know, the same bag of groceries? Well, yeah. It's not your imagination. It's right. So last week, the government statisticians, they publish the Consumer Price Index. And that's the main index that we use to gauge what's happening with inflation. And it was up 5% over the past 12 months. So that was really the biggest increase since 2008, grabbed a lot of attention.
Since 2008, the biggest increase?
Yeah, since August 2008. Is that something? So I looked at the food component, and it was up 2.2% over the past 12 months, and a little less than half is the food at home index, and then a little more than half came from the food away from home. So when we're going to a restaurant, we're paying a little bit more for that food. Now, here's the thing, Angela. The Department of Agriculture came out with some forecasts, and looking at the numbers, they expect things like meat, mm-hmm. poultry, fresh fruit, that these prices are going to go up in coming months. So if you're at the grocery store, you may want to try and take advantage of some discounts, some promotions, all those classic ways to try and lower your grocery bill.
Well, we've always known eating healthy is more expensive than eating things that, you know, are not so healthy. But so we can expect the prices, you said, with the forecast to continue to go up.
That's right. So, or at least not come down. And because there's a couple things that have come together, Angela. You have some of the bad weather in the Midwest had an impact on crops. You had increase exports to China in terms of corn and soybean, transportation costs. But mm-hmm. the main thing is in every conversation you have, it's what's the impact of the pandemic? And the pandemic has had an impact on supply chains. So you sort of take everything together, and at least for the foreseeable future, we're going to be spending more at the grocery store.
Well, as we talk about spending, there have been a lot of conversations, I know, about inflation. A great deal of concern that prices on lots of things are going to just keep spiraling higher.
Oh, this is there are two hot topics right now in Wall Street and Washington, D.C., and inflation is one of them. And there was a very nice essay in the Wall Street Journal, Weekend Wall Street Journal. And it looked back at the 1960s and 1970s and about high and rising prices back then, which really was the last time we had really bad inflation. And Angela's story starts out, it's the fall of 1966, massive demonstrations around the country. It wasn't about the Vietnam War. It wasn't for racial justice. It was protests at supermarkets against rising grocery prices. So we don't have that going on right now, but there is a lot of concern about it. The debate is, are we going back to something like the 1970s, a high rising sustained inflation, or is this transitory as we come out of the pandemic? I think the bulk of evidence that we have says that it's largely going to be transitory, and that seems to be what investors are telling us if you look at the bond market. So we're going to have some consumer price pressures. We have these supply chain problems. It's going to cost you more to buy that sofa. It's going to cost you more to buy some meat. But as these supply chains get refurbished, there's more hiring going on. The expectation, and I think this, the expectation is right, that the price pressures will abate.
So how will this affect home buying, for example?
So the home buying market is it's kind of unbelievable, isn't it? It is so strong. Now, the last time we had strong home prices, we had the bubble. I mean, we had the home price bubble, and it burst. I mean, 2008, 2009 was driven by prices where it went into the stratosphere of the home market. All of a sudden, people look around and say the emperor has no clothes, and boom, you had a crash, and it took the economy with it. This time is really different. There's less financial shenanigans going on the financing side, and it's largely driven by a lack of supply and a strong desire for people to own, and also changing where they want to own. So, you know, one of the conversations, again, that you've had, what was it, on Friday, you know, working from home, and then people were also starting to go back to the office. Well, working from home, people were looking around their downtown apartment and saying, ooh, I'm not so sure I want to be here. So they want at least trying to go to the first ring suburbs. So you have these very, very strong demand for housing, very little supply. I think with some exaggeration, it seems to me you drive every other block in Minneapolis, every three blocks in St. Paul. There's some construction going on. Something is going up. So eventually supply and demand will balance out more. But right now, the housing market is strong.
So does it appear, Chris, that the U.S. economic recovery, that it's strong, that it seems to be on solid ground?
I think it's on solid ground. That's Mark Zandi, his chief economist at Moody's Analytics, and that's what he said. You know, this is an economy on solid ground. It's creating, 500,000 jobs a month. The initial unemployment claims, for the first time since the pandemic started, was under 400,000. It was actually 367,000. And there's some other aspects of this rebound that's going on that is just, in this pandemic recession, very unusual. New businesses. This is a record. This, as far as we're keeping records, this is the fastest pace of new business creation ever. The rate at which workers are quitting their job, which is traditionally that's how you measure confidence in the labor market. You don't quit the job if you don't think you're not going to get another job. People will tend to pull back, right? Well, right now it's at the highest going back to 2000. So people are very confident that they're going to get work. American household debt burdens, the amount of debt that you're carrying, right now it's the lowest level since 1980. Savings rates, which is kind of the other side of that, savings rates are really strong. So from a macroeconomic perspective, this really does look a very strong, very solid recovery. But, and it's a really important but, there's still a lot to be worried about. I'm very concerned. A lot of people are very concerned if the Minnesota ban on rental evictions, mm-hmm. what's going to happen there? Black unemployment, 9.1% compared to 5.1% for whites. And for those without a high school diploma, the labor force participation rate in May was almost 5 percentage points below pre-pandemic levels, whereas those with a bachelor's degree or higher, it was a 1% drop. So this really still is a K-shaped recovery. But the background, the overall macroeconomic background is saying we're on solid ground.
So what are your thoughts about the conversations I keep hearing about higher unemployment benefits and employers saying that they can't find enough workers and that, they just can't fill these open jobs?
Yeah, I find this argument fascinating, and I'm very skeptical about that it's the higher unemployment benefits. And in fact, I want to try something out on you, Angela. I want to reframe this whole discussion, because we keep hearing about, these labor shortages and how bad it is. But here's the thing. What is the definition of a good economy? The definition of a good economy is when firms are looking for workers, not when workers are looking for firms. So I think this is actually a really good thing that employers are seeking workers, they're looking for workers, and, they're having to raise wages, they're having to give special bonuses, they're having to have more flexible benefits, they're having to do many things to attract workers. But there's just also, on a very basic level, good reasons for skepticism. The employment, the Economic Policy Institute, as they point out, the lower wage sectors of the economy, so we've seen faster job growth than the higher wage sectors in recent months. Now, that's the exact opposite of what you would expect if it was these unemployment benefits that were convincing people that I'd rather sit on the couch than go to work. And by the way, that is just a horrible analogy that's out there. People don't want to sit on the couch. People want to be working. But one of the things unemployment benefits allows them to do is to find that better job. Buy some time. Find that better job. Search for that better job. You get better matching between workers and employers. So, that's actually a feature of our unemployment system. It's not a bug. It's not something to complain about. And I also think we are going through a period of time, and Betsy Stevenson, who's an economist at the University of Michigan, wrote about this. We're going through a time where the pandemic caused a lot of evaluation and reevaluation mm-hmm. about life and our goals and our careers and our jobs. And so there's sort of a massive change going on in our economy, and people are looking for different jobs. They're looking for different work. And by the way, commodity prices like copper or lumber, they respond really fast to changes in supply and demand. It takes a long time to find another job. It isn't easy to find another job, even in the best of circumstances. So again, you would expect that it's going to take time. And then I'll stop with one other reason, because I think this is very important. This has been called the she session. If you look at the post-World War II recessions, they were always – men always lost more jobs than women until this recession. And we were at a period of time where schools, some opened, some didn't reopen. They closed because of the heat wave that was coming through. We're going into the summer months. And so it's not exactly surprising that people would be wary of going back to work.
Women.
Particularly women.
We're talking
going
about
back
women.
To work. Yep,
right.
Going back to work. And because of where's the child care? Is there going to be school over the summer? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the rules of the game? And again, I would add that as a factor.
So economists have had a lot of chance to sit back and watch all the changes over the last year and few months. So what do you think we seem to be learning about the changes in the world of work from this pandemic year?
So I think one of the things that we're learning about is we probably are going to move more to a world of hybrid work, not everywhere. And there's a really good example of the divergence of opinion where Goldman Sachs, the investment bank, you're coming back to work. Back to work in the office, that's what it's going to be. Cities.
That's the only choice? There's no hybrid meaning?
There's no choice. You're coming back.
Like remote some days and in office other days?
No.
Not an option at some place?
No.
Okay.
Citi, which is, you know, the giant financial services firm, they've embraced the hybrid. Now, they both believe that this is how they're going to attract talent. They're going to keep talent with very different approaches. But there's this economist at Stanford University, Nicholas Bloom, and he's been doing these very broad-based surveys of employers and employees. And what he's been arguing, and I think this is what we're all going to come down to, is the hybrid is actually the best way to go for two reasons. One, yes, it's absolutely right. There are good reasons why you want to be around other employees. The idea is to come out of lunch. The idea is to come at a chance meeting that you're you're talking to somebody and they go, you know, why don't you think about this? Oh, I hadn't thought about that. All those chance encounters that can happen in the office, those are really valuable. But there are other times it makes more sense to be at home and you'll be more productive. You know, when you're sort of you have to be just doing some writing. So using our profession, you just have to do some writing. You know, you need to close off that world. You need to look at your notes. You need to figure out what it is I'm trying to say here. So it may be more productive to work from home. So my guess is one of the changes is we do move that toward hybrid. It becomes a more dominant model.
Well, you know, in terms of creativity and productivity, you want employees who want to doing the work for you, who want to be there.
That's
right. And yes, sometimes it is better to be collaborating with your team and eating cake. And sometimes it's better.
That was good cake. I've got to tell you.
I know. I found it very inspiring. Yes. And sometimes it is better to be in an isolated situation or someplace you can be comfortable or right. So I'm curious about this hybrid model. Will we see more of that? In all fields, right?
In all fields. And then the other thing that's coming out that is really strong, and this is the rise in entrepreneurship, people being self-employed, solopreneurs, starting their own business. And this is really coming out of COVID. The Kauffman Foundation, which is based in Kansas City, and they really follow, they have some of the best data on entrepreneurship in the country. And their data shows that the rate of entrepreneurship substantially higher in 2020 than in 2019 or in any previous years. And the rate of new entrepreneurs was highest among the 45 to 54-year age group, and the second highest was the 54 to 64-year-old age group. And so, you know, I don't think these people are going to come back to work. I don't think they're going to come back as employees. I think that's also feeding into this discussion that we're having about why can't employers deal with their job? Because there's a group of people who have said, you know what? I think I'm going to be my own boss. I'm going to run my own business. Yes, you pushed me out early in the pandemic and I went into unemployment, but I'm not coming back to you because I figured out how to make a living without being an employee. And this may be one of the most powerful effects of the pandemic on the job market.
Yeah, we've all reevaluated how we see ourselves as employees and potential employers ourselves, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Right.
Wow. A lot to digest there, Chris. I appreciate your time. I'm glad to have you back on Mondays. You'll be back next Monday as well. I'm happy to report.
I will be here. I'm looking forward to
it. That is NPR's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell. Thank you, Chris. And we will talk to you next Monday. This conversation today was produced by NPR's Susan Davis and Samantha Matsumoto. Hi, I'm Angela Davis, and you just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet me at Angela Davis NPR. If you missed us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. Thanks for listening.